Yes. Good morning, everyone. I would invite us all to quiet ourselves as we listen to Rich Norris do a beautiful prelude from Schubert, the Impromptu in G flat.
Thank you. morning, everyone. My name is Carol Goldman, and I'm the newest member of the Board of Trustees of this congregation. We welcome all regardless of age, race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, religious background, or political affiliation, factors that can separate people in our culture. If this is your first time visiting us, please join us after the services for refreshments, which will be served in the back of the room. Feel free to take any brochures on UUism that are on the wall near the outside door and a copy of our latest newsletter, which is also outside. Feel free to sign our guest book in the entry hall if you haven't already done so. And people with name tags, which mine is at home, are members of the congregation and will be happy to tell you about us. And because our services do differ week to week, we encourage you to return two or three times so you can get a better understanding of the variety of our worship service. Again, welcome everyone. We look forward to talking with you and getting to know you better. Thank you.
Thank you, Carol. And a very good initiation, the first timer. Our many different paths come together in this special place, graced by the history of our free church heritage. Let us be mindful of the forces deep within which call us to become more than what we are. May this hour bring rest and renewal, comfort and challenge. May we be reminded here of our highest aspirations and inspired to bring our gifts of love and service to the altar of humanity. May we know once again that we are not isolated beings, but that we are connected in mystery and in miracle to the universe, to this community, and to each other. Amen. And now Rebecca, our Director of Religious Education, will light our chalice. If you may rise.
May the light of this flame
illuminate our lives and strivings of the Spirit. May it heal misunderstanding and strengthen love.
Let us now also say together the words of our affirmation found in your order of service.
Love is this doctrine of this fellowship. The quest for truth is its sacrament, and service is its prayer. To dwell together in peace, to seek truth in love, to serve humanity in fellowship, to the end that all souls shall grow into harmony. Thus do we covenant with one another.
Before we start our fellowship greeting, which is the next thing on our order of service, I would call your attention to the hymn we will sing directly after it, number 298, Wake Now My Senses. You may wish to open your hymnals to that before you now greet one another.
Thank you.
Please be seated.
Anything special?
Now it is time for our children to go to their classrooms. So if our children and all the teachers as well, to go to your classroom. So let's sing them out. Now, as always, is a very special time in our Sunday worship together, a time with where we, as a community, as a whole community, share our joys and concerns and sorrows with one another as a way that we can develop our love, our support, and our closeness with one another. If you have such a joy or concern or sorrow, please feel free to come up, light a candle, and tell us what it is into the mic.
Good morning. I'm Pat Compton, and I would like to light this candle with a prayer that people in our country who believe that church and state should be separate, and that the people who feel that the state should be infused by the church can find a way to meet and compromise and move on without division.
Amen.
This is a candle of sorrow for John Kerry losing. Mm-hmm. I'm a bad loser. But it was also a candle of joy because this time I really got involved in the political process. For me, that's a sign of maturity instead of just sitting back. Also another candle of joy for my daughter, Hannah, whose field hockey team won the season undefeated this year. And she got her first sports jacket, so she's very proud of that. Thank you.
Which I think she's wearing today?
Yes, which she's wearing, so.
Congratulations.
Hi, I'm Ann Jaffe, and I'd like to light a candle of remembrance for a very young friend, 17 years old. It's coming up on a year since Graham's death. And his life was a very beautiful one for such a short one. And the candle is to remember him.
This is a candle to remind everyone to please bring in boxed cookies for the food pantry.
Would you like to say that again into the mic, Linda, so everyone can hear that? It's an
really
important.
I really don't want to be here doing this, but yeah. I'll say it one more time.
Into the mic, real close to the mic.
Please bring in cookies for the food pantry. I just want to make sure that we get our 70 boxes so I don't have to go out at the last minute and purchase them.
And we need to do this before, by what date? Two Sundays, the Sunday before Thanksgiving? So by November 21st. All right, so bring in box cookies, tins of cookies, et cetera, right? Okay. You have heard it here.
This candle I light. For any unspoken joys, concern, or sorrow that might be unspoken, but still very much with us, may we keep all of these candles and what they represent, be they spoken or unspoken, in our minds and in our hearts and in our prayers this coming week. Well, it has been quite a week, as many of us are well aware, and as we have had a couple of candles reminding us about this morning as well. And one of my colleagues, who very much lamented the election results, emailed me an old favorite poem that struck him again anew. And this one is called The Second Coming by William Butler Yeats, Long in His Grave. He wrote this poem in 1919, right at the end of World War II, when people for much of the world, and certainly in Europe and America, were feeling perhaps a bit as some of us have felt this past week with the election results. I know it was true for him and somewhat for me as well. And Yeats said long ago, "Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all convictions, while the worst are full of passionate intensity." Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand. The second coming. Hardly are those words out when a vast image out of Spiritus Mundi troubles my sight. A waste of desert sand, a shape with lion body and the head of a man, a gaze blank and pitiless as the sun, is moving its slow thighs while all about it wind shadows of the indignant desert birds. The darkness drops again. But now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle. And what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches towards Bethlehem to be born. So ends our first reading. Well, that may put you in a particular mood, but not to leave you there. My second reading is from Howard Thurman's Meditations on the Heart. Howard Thurman is a favorite of mine. He is in his grave now as well, but only recently so. He was a very powerful theologian, professor at BU, Boston University, in his later years, and was the professor, one of Martin Luther King's teachers, a black man with a very powerful spiritual sense. And this is one of his meditations called Keep Alive the Dream in the Heart. As long as people have a dream in their heart, they cannot lose the significance of living. It is a part of the pretensions of modern life to traffic in what is generally called realism. There is much insistence upon being practical, down to earth. Such things as dreams are wont to be regarded as romantic or as a badge of immaturity or as escape hatches for the human spirit. When such a mood or attitude is carefully scrutinized, it is found to be made up largely of pretensions, in short, of bluff. People cannot continue long to live if the dream in the heart has perished. It is then that they stop hoping, stop looking, and the last embers of their anticipations fade away. The dream in the heart is the outlet. It is one with the living water welling up from the very springs of being, nourishing and sustaining all of life. Where there is no dream, the life becomes a swamp, a dreary, dead place, and deep within, people's hearts begin to rot. The dream need not be some great and overwhelming plan. It need not be a dramatic picture of what might or must be someday. It need not be a concrete outpouring of a world-shaking possibility of sure fulfillment. Such may be important for some. Such may be crucial for a particular moment of human history. But it is not in these grand ways that the dream nourishes life. The dream is the quiet persistence in the heart that enables people to ride out the storms of their churning experiences. It is the exciting whisper moving through the aisles of their spirits, answering the monotony of limitless days of dull routine. It is the ever-recurring melody in the midst of the broken harmony and harsh discords of human conflict. It is the touch of significance, which highlights the ordinary experience, the common event. The dream is no outward thing. It does not take its rise from the environment in which one moves or functions. It lives in the inward parts. It is deep within, where the issues of life and death are ultimately determined. Keep alive the dream. For as long as we have dreams in our heart, we cannot lose the significance of living. And so ends our second reading. This congregation is the community of ourselves. Its energy and resources are our energy and resources. Its wealth is what we share as we contribute to the life of this community. We affirm our lives within it. This morning's offering will now be taken. Thank you. Let us take a few moments of silence to find our center, to settle into it and focus our lives that we might be whole persons. Though our imagination be infinite, our ideals sublime, and our vision unbounded, we are mortal creatures nevertheless. We live in history, subject to the transience of flesh and of days. Our individuality separates us. Our struggles weaken us, and death always waits at our left. Let each of us take a moment of silent recollection to enter into our own experience of the past week. Focus upon one event of paradox or perplexity, consternation or relief, and seek its connection with the larger forces of life, which enfolds us all. There are times when life is less than we desire, times when forces beyond our control confound us, and times when we are not what we might have been. Let us look within ourselves to find and acknowledge these discontinuities that keep us from growing, and those powers that are waiting to be realized if we would set them free. In the sacred stillness of a shared silence, let us listen to the wisdom of our own hearts and minds. And now let us continue to meditate, pondering the glories and the mysteries in our lives, listening to the wisdom of our hearts and minds. We know ultimately that life is good, rich with possibilities. We give thanks for our portion of the good and trust that each new day will bring strength, courage, wisdom, and renewal. Amen. And now let us sing our next hymn together, number 86, Blessed Spirit of My Life. Please be seated. Well, the pundits and the commentators and the critics have all weighed in with their post-election opinions, be they lamenting ones, ruminating ones, or celebratory ones. One political cartoon caught my eye. It was a map of the United States and Canada. Some of you may have seen it. Canada and most of the northern states, plus California, those that voted for Kerry, were colored in pink, and the southern and midwestern states that voted for Bush were shaded in green. The cartoon was entitled "The United States of Canada and Jesus Land." The implication being, of course, that our nation is so far divided that the North might consider seceding from our present nation, joining Canada, and leaving the rest of the nation to its supposedly conservative Christian proclivities. No matter how we may feel about the election's outcome, one thing the pundits are saying seems true. And that is that we as a nation are more polarized than we have been in decades. We as a nation not only have widely differing party loyalties and ideologies, but also very different priorities and even very different understandings of what reality is. I have talked to those who abhor Bush, and they say such things as, "I can't understand how anyone can see any good in that guy. He will create a fascist state before he's done." And I have talked to some Bush supporters, some of whom are members of my own extended family, who feel that bleeding heart liberals are arrogant and self-righteous and will ruin this country and all it stands for if they have their way. We do have a tendency to demonize the other side. I know I have that tendency too. Besides a wide rift between the generic conservative versus liberal or Republican versus Democrat, we have urban folk versus the rural folk, the haves versus the have-nots, the environmentalists versus business, pro-Iraqi war versus anti-Iraqi war, pro-abortion versus anti-abortion, pro-gun control versus anti-gun control, pro-gays and anti-gays, and even some who are pro-gays but are anti-gay marriage. We also differ in our definition of moral values. An exit poll found that 52% of the voters use the issue of moral values as their criterion for deciding for whom to vote. For some, however, moral values meant their stance on such things as gay marriage and being unwavering and single-minded in one's decisions. For others, moral values meant a mandate to be helpful to those in need, taking care of all equally, and being responsible for environmental issues. We cannot even perceive moral values in the same way. We seem to be indeed slouching towards such a sharp division as to perceive ourselves as two distinct nations. We seem to be adamant in our individual opinions, individual perceptions of what is important, even of what is real in our world today. We do not seem to be open to much listening to the other side. We do not seem to be able to see how another might have his or her own legitimate reasons for believing as they do. Well, it is our private right as United States citizens to hold to our own perceptions on things. We live in a free country where we can think and believe as we want. We Unitarian Universalists based on the same democratic ideals that birthed our nation, also staunchly support and even revere our freedom to think and act as our individual inclinations dictate. After all, we have no church dogma telling us what we should believe. It is our individual right to search for our own meaning, our own beliefs. But what of the common good? What of the rights of the nation as a whole? What of the rights of our whole congregations? What are the rights of our whole neighborhoods? What are the rights of whole families and not just individual members? How do we meld the rights of the individual with that of what is good and necessary for any corporate society to function well? A retired history professor at a Quaker graduate school of religion, Murray Wagner, once said this quite a few years ago now. He said, "We use individual rights as a basis for arguing a cause rather than for promoting public responsibility." I'll repeat that. We use individual rights as a basis for arguing a cause rather than for promoting public responsibility. Whether you believe that private right trumps public responsibility or not, it does give one pause. Our strong sense of individual rights, that sense that was a basic premise to our Declaration of Independence, can be seen as something to which we feel entitled above all else. Is it that we feel so strongly entitled to our individual beliefs of what is right and just that we cannot see beyond our own heartfelt causes to what is perhaps good for the whole? Is it that we are truly failing in our responsibility as a public citizen to think and act for the good of the whole, to keep foremost what is for the good of our public lives together? Is it that we may think that our cause is for the good of the whole? But even then, can we entertain that our opinion of what is good for the whole is just our opinion, open to debate as well? It may mean that we have to compromise on a cherished ideal if we are to truly be responsible to our public good. It may mean that we may have to adapt our thinking into something that both sides can live with for the good of the whole. It may mean that we cannot always get exactly what we want, even if we truly believe that what we want is essential for our communal survival. For instance, we may be very concerned about the environmental issue of global warming and toxic emissions in our atmosphere. But we do have the business issue to consider, too. A factory spewing toxic gases does serve the society as well and may have concerns for its survival if the cost of revamping their emissions is so dear. It requires us to listen to opposing ideals and needs, perhaps, to try to understand where people are coming from when they espouse such differing ideas from our own. It may require us to give a little to get a little, at the very least. A factory can listen to environmental concerns and acknowledge the harmful effects of their emissions and try to gradually change the way they promote their emissions. Environmentalists can concede that businesses are needed for the good of our economy and public well-being, and concede that changes in emissions may have to happen more slowly than they'd like or even feel necessary. The common good here is both a toxic-free environment and the economy. We need to address them both. It is very difficult to do. Difficult to adapt and adjust and let go of some of our ideals, perhaps, in our compromising efforts. But it is not impossible. I alluded earlier to some of my extended family members being rather conservative. The most conservative of them all is my brother of just 1 year younger than me, than I, who is a fundamentalist Christian, Pentecostal, has spoken in tongues, the whole bit. And I'm his sister. In the early days after his conversion from atheist to fundamentalist, he's gone through. I've not leaped that far, but he has. In the early days after his conversion, every time we would meet, he would try to convert me, the liberal, humanist, you older sister. It was a cause he felt mandated to try and do. Quite a task. At first, we would have heated discussions on religion, each trying to prove his or her point of view of what was good for the soul, what was good for humanity. We even ventured into politics with the same result. We were not listening to each other so much as spewing out our opinions, our own beloved and ardently believed causes. But a breakthrough finally occurred when I got somehow the brainy idea to say to him, "Michael, words don't mean as much to me as actions. Show me by what you do, how you lead your life, how you treat me and everyone and everything else, that your religion guides you to a strong, loving, and right kind of character, and maybe I might become interested." Ha ha. After some negotiation, we agreed not to talk religion or politics anymore, and to concentrate more on our commonalities than on our particular, rather discordant beliefs. When we now get together, we talk about our own common ground, our families, the daily sorrows and joys we all share, and such things as who might win an Olympic event. We can jointly organize and spend a family holiday together and enjoy each other's company in a most elemental but satisfying way. We honor our commonalities and concentrate on those. We work to promote the stability and harmony of our family, our common goal and common good here. No, I don't think we will ever become bosom buddies, or that I or he will ever convert to each other's way of thinking. I will never be as close to him as I am to my other brother, who is a spiritually minded, new agey liberal, with whom I have much accord. But our fundamentalist brother and I can still have a relationship that works on some level. Yes, we are more careful with each other, mindful to be respectful of each other as valued human beings. Even though he is very sad, I will not be joining him in his idea of heaven because I have not accepted Jesus Christ in my life as he has. We can still agree to disagree and still join hands on a most elementary level. I say thank you to him when he says he prays for my damned soul, and he says thank you when I pray for the health and well-being of his wife and sons. We have learned to come together as persons, equally worthy. We have learned to come together for the sake of the common good of our family. Can the liberals and conservatives of our nation come together in a similar way? Can we reconsider what are our most basic common bonds and celebrate them and promote them? I think both sides have more similar values than dissimilar ones. We all believe in the ideals of the founding fathers of our nation, even if we interpret them differently from time to time, as it can and does happen inevitably. In our own denomination, we have two predominant belief patterns that sometimes are a bit polarizing within our individual congregations and within our Unitarian Universalist spheres. One is the humanist beliefs that were very predominant for much of the last century of the history of UUism. And the other is the rising beliefs in some sort of spiritual transcendent entity, perhaps different from the old Christian ones, and our relationship to that transcendent entity. How do we honor both of them? How do we accept differing opinions and beliefs as they color the way we wish our congregations to worship, as they color the direction we wish our congregations to go? I can remember attending our Unitarian Universalist General Assembly in Cleveland in 2001, where we were to elect a new president of our Unitarian Universalist Association, something we do every 4 years. One candidate for the UUA's presidency, Diane Miller, was a lifelong UU, had done impressive ministerial parish work before she became the director of the UU Ministers Association in Boston. She became a minister way back in the early days when a female UU minister was a rarity in the early 70s. And she had worked for women's rights in all spheres of society, as well as for other social issues. In my opinion, she represented the old established order of Unitarian Universalism, largely humanist. If she were elected also, she'd be the first woman president of our denomination, in any denomination. Quite a feather in our collective cap, if she were elected. The other candidate was William Sinkford, a black man raised a UU, but one who had left the denomination as a very young man in the late 60s because of the way he perceived blacks were treated in our denomination at that time. There were many blacks who who did leave our denomination back then over issues concerning how much we were willing to finance their cause of civil rights. After much time, he returned to Unitarian Universalism, became ordained, and was so impressive in his work for the denomination that he had recently been named the Director of Congregational Services in Boston. In my opinion, he represented the newly emerging order of more spirit, some order that was more spiritual, perhaps. If he were elected, he'd be the first black person to serve as president of our UUA. And it just might help to heal the old rifts around black issues, too. It was a vibrant campaign, with people very strongly for or against either candidate. Much debate, much divergent opinions over who would be best to lead us in our future. Much anxiety. Well, Bill Sinkford, as many of you know, won that election. The first thing he said, I remember I heard him do it. First thing he said in his first public speech in Cleveland after the election was, "Take off all those campaign buttons. Put away all those campaign signs and placards." For him, working toward reconciliation and rejecting divisiveness was and is still key. For him, it was much more important to speak with one strong voice than to continue to dwell on our differences. He said that there is far more that brings us together than divides us. We only have one destiny as a denomination, just as each of our congregations only have one destiny. Just as we have only one destiny as a nation here today, political cartoons and their messages aside. We do not have to remain so separate, so divided that we think, even in jest, that secession and remapping of our nation is the only answer. We can find ways to bind up our nation's wounds again, just as we have done in the past in our history. We can find ways to embrace our differences, respect them, honor them, and then reach some sort of working compromise, some sort of consensus even. We can do this in our nation, in our congregations, in our own families, in other personal relationships. It may not be perfect. We may not be completely satisfied. It may not be exactly as individuals may have hoped, but it will serve us well if we work toward accord together in a spirit of what is good for our common whole. And that lies our future that will indeed promote the common good of all. Amen. Now let us sing our last hymn, number 121, We'll Build a Land. Yes, I'm here to remembering again Thurman's words. May we keep alive the dream, for as long as we have a dream in our hearts, We cannot lose the significance of living. Let us say together the words of our chalice extinguishing. Carry the flame of peace and love until we meet again. And let us now say together, sing together.
Go now in peace, go now.